From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from the Central, South America, and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Well, first, before we get into this, we've got the report that came from Susie Dawson, who's been working on the solidarity actions with Julian Assange, that there was an attempted break-in at the Ecuadorian embassy with apparently someone intending to try to haul Julian out of the embassy and hand him over to the U.S. or whatever person they'd be handing him over to, foiled because of a booby trap that was set up inside the embassy by Assange to tip people off to what was happening. At the moment, he seems safe, but the government of Lenny Moreno seems to be doing some sort of, I guess you'd have to call it astroturf organizing inside Ecuador, you know, with some people saying, hand Assange over and, you know, get him out of the embassy. I don't think yet that he has popular support for that, though, and so we're just kind of watching that.
Right, but that's all part of what's going on in Ecuador itself generally, yep. Where it's absolutely clear that Lenin Moreno, Ecuador's president, has taken on a vendetta against every vestige of Rafael Correa's very successful previous administrations.
Including Correa himself.
I'm sorry?
Including Correa himself.
Including Correa himself, yeah. I know Correa, I think it was early last week, an attempt to get Interpol to put out a red alert for Rafael Correa, completely absurd, was rejected precisely because it was absurd.
Right.
But I mean, the attempts continue, and inside Ecuador itself, former Vice President Jorge Glass, who was imprisoned very much along the same lines as Brazil's former President Lula da Silva, basically because a judge, despite not having any hard evidence, thought that it was extremely likely that he would have been guilty of what he was accused of. And on that basis, Jorge Glass was condemned to, I think it was 6-7 years in jail. He's now on hunger strike because he was moved from, because he's not a high priority prisoner in the sense that he's dangerous, like the leader of a drugs cartel or something like that. Despite that, he was moved from a low security prison to the highest level security prison, with restrictions on visits and even interviews with his legal advisors. And so he's gone on hunger strike. He's been on hunger strike for 3 weeks now. Now in his third week of hunger strike. And there's a lot of concern at the highest level internationally. Evo Morales has expressed concern about Jorge Glass's health. And Lenin Moreno has turned out to be such a vindictive individual. There's very little likelihood of any relaxation in the measures that are being taken against Jorge Glass. And to compound what the legal attacks on Rafael Correa, who's at the moment at least safe in Belgium, where he lives with his Belgian wife, and the legal attack against Jorge Glass. In addition to that, Lenin Moreno and his administration, his cronies in the legal branches that the government controls, are going after other relatively minor functionaries from the Rafael Correa administration, the previous Rafael Correa administration. It looks as though it's just kind of a general witch hunt against anybody who remains loyal to Rafael Correa and the ideals that Rafael Correa's political movement embodied, that Lenin Moreno has comprehensively betrayed.
Yeah, I mean, if this were the Soviet Union, they'd call it a purge. But that's what's happening.
Yeah, and I think calling it a purge would would be very much on the mark.
Yep.
And of course, that's the. But what's so also on the, in one sense, it's not surprising, but it's still disturbing that across the region, these legal attacks and other kinds of harassment of progressive political leaders are being carried out with such vindictive intensity. And you can see that in the way the Argentinian authorities are going after Cristina Kirchner.
Right.
And it's not, and you see, one of the interesting things is that any politician that expresses the least kind of support for the very concept of national sovereignty is being targeted.
Right.
And like, so you in Guatemala, you've got the ongoing power struggle between the government of Jimmy Morales and that section of the Guatemalan elite that supports Jimmy Morales, who very successfully moved against their rivals, another set of people in the Guatemalan elite, when they ousted Otto Perez, the previous president.
Right.
And that section of the elite in Guatemala supporting Jimmy Morales is now in conflict with the United States and its United Nations proxies.
Right.
Over whether or not the Guatemalan government will allow the Commission Against Impunity, which is a UN body in Guatemala, there's also a similar body in Honduras, to resume its normal operation with a head approved by the United Nations and the United States. Because Jimmy Morales is refusing entry to the individual that was supposed to take up that post.
Yep.
So, and you see the same. So why is the United States, and why is it it's kind of the tool that it's using in Guatemala, which is the UN Commission Against Impunity, why are they targeting Jimmy Morales? Obviously because Jimmy Morales and that section of the Guatemalan elite aren't doing exactly what they're told.
Right.
And so you have the same kind of thing going on in Peru, for example, where an outfit called CELAG, which is a very well-respected kind of center-left and generally quite progressive think tank research body run mainly by people from Colombia and Argentina and other countries in South America. They don't have anybody from the Caribbean, which is why they sometimes get things wrong about Central America and the Caribbean. But they produced a study recently about Peru, and they found that in general there's a widespread disenchantment with all politicians in Peru. And of course that's a phenomenon that's current in many, many countries, including the United States, I should imagine. But in Peru, what is going on is part of the political process that's going on in Peru is an attempt by the elite to respond in a credible, plausible way to popular disenchantment with the political classes, and they've gone after Keiko Fujimori, who very, very nearly became Peru's president a couple of years ago, when she was running against Kuczynski, who was subsequently forced to resign from office because of his association with corruption.
Right.
Essentially because he pardoned former dictator Alberto Fujimori, Keiko Fujimori's father.
Right.
But Keiko Fujimori was the leader of a very strong right-wing movement in Peru, and now she's in jail classified as preventive detention because of her alleged involvement in corrupt activities involving campaign financing, as I understand it. But again, she wouldn't be in jail if the United States ambassador said that she shouldn't be. Okay?
Right.
So, again, you know, you have to ask, what is it that Keiko Fujimori was trying to defend that the United States authorities didn't like?
Right.
Because so then, I think that's something that. And what I'm trying to get across is that there's this general offensive, based, as you have said many times in previous conversations, based on this motif about corruption, that is used essentially as a political tool to eliminate people who are inconvenient for U.S. and allied elite interests in the region.
Right. Right. It's a non-ideological, quote-unquote, like on its face. It's a non-ideological weapon. Hey, look, we don't care if you're left, right, center, or whatever. If you're an honest, straightforward person, you're okay with us. And if you're a crook, you're out. Of course, I get to decide who's a crook.
Yeah, and that's the essential thing, isn't it? And as right. as I was explaining last week, and between kind of trying to formulate the idea, which I have difficulty sometimes trying to keep the flow of ideas keep running coherently.
Comes with age, doesn't it?
But the thing about that is that what the United States has done ever since the 1990s. I remember in the late 1980s when I worked in Honduras, in the early 1990s when I worked in Honduras, being puzzled about because the USAID was seen to be running really quite progressive human rights programs, human rights education programs. Mm-hmm. And back then, what are you talking about? 20, almost 30 years ago now. And I was just puzzled about what is this huge contradiction between them promoting this human rights education stuff and at the time they were still running death squads in Honduras. Right. And so the answer is clear 30 years later. And what they were doing was laying the groundwork, laying the foundations to develop a class of functionaries in both in NGOs, in non-governmental organizations, and in the legal systems and criminal systems of their target countries who are loyal to the ideal of and the needs of and the foreign policy imperatives of the United States.
Right.
And they carried that off extremely successfully across the region, to the extent that one of their star pupils, Silvio Moro, has now been invited by Jair Bolsonaro, the president-elect of Brazil, to be his justice minister.
Right.
Now, and this is a low-level legal functionary, a low-level judicial functionary, whose main claim to fame is the persistent legal harassment based on no evidence at all, based on false evidence that he concocted, based on breaking the law himself by violating all accepted judicial procedures, leaking information that was privileged and very selectively to right-wing media, making arrangements with right-wing media so that they would be on the scene for staged searches of Lula da Silva's house and processes whereby he'd have to go to Silvio Moro to be interviewed. All that Silvio Moro staged very carefully in media terms. And so you have this complete corruption of judicial process and accepted legal procedures by the person who is now being named by Brazil's fascist president-elect as Brazil's new justice minister.
Brother.
And that is a glowing success for U.S. policy in the region in terms of its training and education program to put in place a class of functionaries that will do what they're told.
Well, we've also discussed...
Or don't even need to be told.
Right, right, right. And it doesn't matter who's told what anyway, as we've discussed, because the media landscape, the entire communications apparatus, more or less in Brazil, in Argentina, in so many places in that region, privately owned by the oligarchy and the same people that own the judiciary. So, you had the military dictatorships, the juntas, all of that, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, depending on which place, when, where, which junta, which military dictator, Pinochet, or whoever, you know, they selected a lot of the judges that still sit on the bench now and certainly set up the construct by which the remaining judges were selected. That's the judiciary and the reporting of, you know, who did what, when, where, and how on their way in and out of court goes through press that's owned by the same character. So if you elect a leftist government, both inside the presidency and even, which they haven't really managed to do, but even if you elected a majority in the legislature, you still are at the whim of the right wing, the far right wing, the fascists, basically, who can say, that guy's a crook, they'll beat, you know, play that from the rafters throughout the entire media scape, and a judge that'll say, yep, you're right, 20 years, and that's that.
Yeah, and the thing is that, and if you look at why are left-wing movements and left-wing leaders in the predicament that they're currently in? It's because they were too nice, you know, and if they... If they'd been guilty of what they'd been accused of for around 10 years, from between about 2006 to 2015...
Right, they'd be living in Switzerland.
They would actually have taken control of the judiciary. They would actually have shut down the media.
That's right.
You know, and they would have been able to protect themselves.
Yep.
Or take measures to ensure that it was much more difficult for the right wing than it was. They'd have shut down all those U.S. training programs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but because they were doing their best to be genuinely democratic, something that the right wing wouldn't know what it was if it hit them in the face.
Right.
Because they were trying to be genuinely democratic, they accepted the status quo and tried to work with the status quo, and they shouldn't have done. And if you look at what's happened in the archetypal example of how to do things is Cuba, right?
Yeah.
But for countries like Venezuela and Nicaragua, that hasn't been an option.
That's correct.
In Cuba, they completely transformed the system, so there isn't a trace of the kind of bourgeois kind of institutions, the phony elections that are carefully, the elections themselves might not be rigged, but the whole electoral process is rigged, as we saw in Brazil.
Right.
I'm sure that the elections in Brazil, on the whole, were free and fair in the sense of the count. But as you pointed out last week, and they took place when, in a context where the most popular candidate had been locked up in a completely unjust way, the right wing media controlled the whole media campaign, and the fascist candidate who successfully won the election, Jair Bolsonaro, was allowed to break all kinds of electoral rules,
right,
in terms of his campaigning and his use of fake news smearing the opposition candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a whole series of factors.
Oh, and then, the input context for this is that the last elected leftist president was illegally removed from office. And so the election was conducted by some people who were in power thanks to a coup.
Correct. Another essential component to understand about what happened. So, you know, and that what you have is a kind of completely phony democratic framework in which that has been in place, that was put in place following the military dictatorships of the 1980s. And left-wing parties and progressive movements have been trying to work in that. And much to the concern of the United States, who thought they had everything sewn up in the early 2000s, Hugo Chavez won the election in Venezuela in 1998 and proceeded to completely overturn, using that same democratic framework, he successfully overturned the bourgeois control of the Venezuela's institutions,
right,
and by means of the Bolivarian Revolution, of which he was the visionary architect. He has enabled the Venezuelan progressive movement, and in particular the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, the governing party there, to defend itself by perhaps not having complete control of the judiciary and the central bank and an adequate media presence and all these things, but they have sufficient control to be able to neutralize attempts by the right wing to overthrow the government. And the same thing is true in Nicaragua. Now, if you look at what's happening in Nicaragua and Venezuela, it was very interesting the other day. I know. I think I put it up on the website. I translated it with a friend, Janet Pavone. We translated a long interview with Venezuelans and Bolivians participating in a peace and solidarity forum here in Nicaragua, in Managua. And in the interview, the journalist doing the interview asked them, "Well, what do you think about the experience that you've been learning about here in Nicaragua?" And they say, "Well, it's igualito. It's exactly the same as what happened to us in Venezuela.
Right.
The opposition thugs setting fire to people, but burning people alive. The attacks on children. The roadblocks, which in Nicaragua are called tranques, and in Venezuela they're called guarimbas. These barricades that." Right. Opposition activists set up to intimidate and extort the local population, and they said everything's the same. Even the lies are the same.
Right.
And so, what that means for anybody trying to understand what's going on in Latin America and the Caribbean is that they really do need to understand what has been the experience of Nicaragua and Venezuela, and Nicaragua this year and Venezuela over the last 3, 4, 5 years,
right,
ever since President Hugo Chavez died back in 2013. And the experience has been that, for example, here in Nicaragua, that one big lie is there's no freedom of expression. Why do they promote that lie? Because the opposition control the 2 or 3 main newspapers, they control most of the local radio stations, they control most of the local cable TV stations, and they have around half of the national TV stations.
Right.
So why do they claim that there's no freedom of expression in Nicaragua? Precisely because the fact that there is sufficient media presence on the part of the progressive government prevents them from completely brainwashing the population.
This is what they do too.
They almost achieved that via social media back in April.
Yep.
But that effect quickly wore off.
I mean, that's what they did during the coup in Venezuela in 2002. At the time, there was only one channel that the government had access to, and the remaining TV channels were all owned by the oligarchs. So that one of the first things that they did was knock out the transmitter at the government station so that the media portrait of the coup was portrayed entirely by the coupsters.
Right. And so in Brazil, you won't read about military repression in Brazil, not in the mainstream media. You won't read about police repression in Argentina. You generally won't read about military repression and police repression in Mexico, for example, although we're likely to read more about that now that a progressive president will be taking office on December the 1st. But in Nicaragua and Venezuela, you constantly read about military repression and police repression. Why are you constantly reading about that in the corporate media? Because the governments there control the armed forces and the police.
Right.
There, the police and the army support the government.
Right.
Why do they do that? Because the army and the police come from ordinary people and are loyal to their popular base.
Right.
They're not bought off like the police forces and the army in other countries.
Right, they're not professional, quote-unquote.
To serve the wealthy elites.
Exactly, they're not hired guards, basically.
So that is why the mainstream media in North America and Europe and Latin America, generally the corporate media, accuse the military and the police in Nicaragua and Venezuela of being repressive, because they don't control them. They don't answer to the imperatives and needs of the United States and local regional elites.
That's right.
And why do they talk about corruption? Why do they talk about corruption in Nicaragua and Venezuela, but then they're not that concerned about it? In the United States itself, for example, and just think about military spending in the United States and the corruption that's involved in that. But they will make corruption a key theme of their attacks on the Nicaraguan and Venezuelan judiciary. Why? Because they don't control the Nicaraguan and Venezuelan judiciary.
Right.
And so when you read people, when reading accounts in the mainstream media about events in Nicaragua and Venezuela, then they need to kind of be rational about what they're reading and critical about what they're reading, because otherwise it just doesn't make sense. Why would people rise up in Nicaragua against a government that's done more for ordinary people than any government in the last century, apart from the revolutionary government that was in the 1980s that was forced into a war by the United States?
Right.
You know, and the Venezuelan government, why do they keep winning elections?
Right.
Why does the Nicaraguan government keep winning elections? Oh, the mainstream media will say, oh, it's because they're corrupt and they rig the elections. Right. But unfortunately, international observers and international visitors accompanying the elections deny that. Even the Carter Center says that Venezuela's elections and electoral system is the best in the world.
Right.
You know, people reading coverage of Nicaragua and Venezuela need to be very critical about what's going on. And for example, the whole phenomenon of migrants in the migrants heading for the United States currently crossing Mexico, and the mainstream media coverage has been reasonably accurate in characterizing where they're from. They really haven't said much about why are all these people from, in particular, Honduras and El Salvador, and also from Guatemala, heading for the United States.
Right.
And why are they not vastly outnumbered by people fleeing this terrible, tyrannical, repressive, corrupt regime in Nicaragua?
Right.
Well,
look, that are the people that you know who have been murdered by their repressive government. Where were they from, and who, you know, in what country were they murdered? You know, Berta was not murdered by the Nicaraguan government, for example. Others, you know, the same. The death squads are not in Nicaragua. They're not in Venezuela. They operate in Colombia. They operate in El Salvador. They operate in Guatemala. They operate in Honduras. These are products of U.S. training, arms supply, ideological orientation, and command and control, by the way, too, because they actually are operating as an extension of U.S. foreign policy, which is directed from the top. So, you know, for them to try to portray this stuff that goes on, that they make people rise up in Nicaragua as being some indigenous, you know, response to the insult of the governments, while they ignore the fact that people are running like crazy away from the U.S. installed governments in Honduras and elsewhere, you know, it makes the whole thing just too much to swallow. We're out of time, Tony, and we're going to have to leave it here. And maybe next week we can pick it up talking about what's been going on in the crisis in Costa Rica, the situation under Duque in Colombia, and maybe an update on what happens in Brazil, because we're going to be watching that closely over the next few weeks.
Okay, I look forward to that, Don. Thanks a million.
The same. Thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.